was born in June 2nd, 1924 in Dorchester, Massachusetts. And my early life was very uneventful, except that I lived at that time through the, my family lived that time through the Depression. And it was very difficult because at that time my father was a bricklayer mason, and he was unemployed. There was just no work for a lot of people. But we struggled through, and my mother was a wonderful cook, and we had plenty of food on the table. I don't know how she did it. Well, I went through all of the public schools in Dorchester, and I graduated Dorchester High School in 1942. However, one would normally graduate in June, you know, latter part of May or June. This time it was during the war, and they allowed us to go out, say in January, to work in the various defense industries. Also at that time, we were 17 years old, a lot of the fellows were volunteering in the various Marines, Navy, and Army. I entered the I was drafted on February 24th, 1943. As soon as I was drafted, we were sent up to Camp Devens in Massachusetts. And we stayed there for approximately 3 days to get all our shots and clothing. Then we boarded day coach trains, the old-fashioned day coach trains where the windows opened on the side and we had a regular steam locomotive. And we didn't know where we were going. Everything was secretive and confidential. And during the day, as we rode in the train, and at night, when we rode in the train, we had to ride with these shades, window shades, drawn down. Then we made a brief stop in the stockyards of Kansas City after a couple of days of riding around. And we had approximately an hour's of walking exercise. However, it took us approximately 7 days and seven nights to finally reach California, where we were to have our basic training. Now, at that time, we didn't know what type of an outfit we were going to be in and where we would wind up. It was just a roll of the dice. If the Army needed infantry, we'd go in infantry. If they needed artillery, we'd go in artillery. Well, we happened to wind up in a in an automatic weapons artillery, field artillery unit. My rank when I first went in was private, and I happened to be a private all the way through the war. The advancement was very slow, but I never regretted it because it didn't make any difference. Money didn't mean anything once we got into combat and overseas. We all wanted to go. To us, at that time, it was the greatest adventure in the world. We really didn't know what we were getting into, nor did we care. We were a bunch of kids, we were 18 years old, and we were having a heck of a time. And they could have done anything with us or to us, and it didn't make any difference. The automatic weapons consisted of a 40-millimeter cannon, which was drawn by a 2.5-ton truck. The cannon had four wheels, and however, if it had to go in a firing position, it had to be lowered So the wheels came up and it rested on the ground. Our other gun was a quad 50 caliber machine gun on an aircraft mounted type turret, which one man operated. So we had 15 men to our gun section, and we would exchange all duties, some at times running the 40 millimeter, at other times running the quad 50. Initially, during our training in the States, our guns were operated mechanically and electrically by some kind of a mechanical computer. And that was my job, to look into the computer scope and focus on an incoming enemy aircraft. And I would, as I moved my scope, the guns would automatically focus on that plane, would automatically lead, and so forth. And however, when we went overseas, this type of setup was very cumbersome because it required a heavy motor generator, and the computer itself on a tripod was very heavy to move. So we gave that away when we went overseas. We trained on the Desert Training Center for about 8 or 9 months in California, Arizona. This training was particularly rugged, and it simulated battle conditions. They were getting us ready. The war in Africa was ongoing at that time, and theoretically, we were training for the war in Africa. However, at the end of our training, approximately around October, November of 43, the war in Africa tapered down and moved to Sicily. So therefore, we were planning to go, our training was completed, we were ready to go overseas. They didn't tell us where we were going. If we thought, since we were on the West Coast, that we would go to the Pacific and fight the Japanese. However, we packed up all of our equipment in large crates, and to show you how rumors pervaded, all the crates had marked on it, stencil marked, TAT. So the guys interpreted that as Tennessee Amphibious Training. And we thought we were going to more training in Tennessee. However, we took off one late at one at night in day coaches, again, with all of our equipment in secret. And in the middle of the morning, say about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the train stopped on the siding in the desert, and drawn up in another track where was another train, which consisted of sleeper cars. Well, we moved to the sleeper cars, and we thought, well, maybe we're going to San Francisco and ship out port of embarkation and go to the Pacific. When we were riding on the sleeper coaches in the middle of nowhere, the sergeant came through the train and announced our destination to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey. So there was a cheer throughout the train, because it brought us a lot closer to home. But we didn't know our ultimate destination. The war in Europe hadn't started yet, the invasion, and at that time they were fighting in Sicily and Italy, so we thought perhaps our ultimate destination would be Italy. It took us about 5 or 6 days to cross the country in secrecy, and we wound up at Camp Kilmer, port of embarkation, Camp Kilmer, New Jersey. We arrived there, and we still didn't know where our ultimate destination. And naturally, there were rumors flying all over the place For example, they called it latrine rumors because you go into the latrine, that was a toilet, and on the walls was inscribed, arrived, say, one day and shipped out 2 days later. And we all thought that since we were in New Jersey, near New York City, that we would be able to have fun, go into New York City and maybe go home. Some of us, you know, a lot of us lived in Boston area. While we were in New York, it wound up that we happened to be there probably about 2 weeks. And at each time, we would receive periodically a pass to go into New York City. And we would go in there and we'd have a good time. And I had an aunt that lived in New York City, and my parents came down to visit me in New York City. Then quite suddenly, we were ordered to pack up everything, go to the docks. Down to the docks one day, and we boarded a Liberty ship. A Liberty ship. This was a new Liberty ship that was had just been built recently at the Kaiser shipyards, but it was turned over to the British to man. And our entire battalion of approximately 900 men boarded this Liberty ship, and it was very crowded because we were in the this was mainly a cargo ship, and we were had to sleep in hammocks and bunks in the hold, and some of my bunk was about four high, and I was the top bunk, and then right on top of me, there was this ventilation duct that kept roaring day and night. However, it took us about 19 days to cross the Atlantic in a stormy January and February time in a convoy. We were asked, since we were artillery, we were asked to serve, take our turns on the deck guns. And one night I was on a deck gun, and in the distance I could see a line of the rest of the convoy silhouetted. And then suddenly one of the ships happened to blow up. There was a big glare in the horizon, and apparently a sub got one of the ships. Right in the middle of the trip, I happened to get seasick because the seas were mountainous, and the ship was a small ship, and it kept rolling back and forth, up and down. So for 3 days I was seasick until somebody brought me some dry crackers. That helped. We finally got to our destination in England. It was Edinburgh. We landed in a castle at Edinburgh, Scotland. We were there. Oh, we were so happy to get off of that ship. And I never would have made I would have made a terrible sailor. Oh, we were happy to arrive to get off that ship. The English people were super. They were very nice. They treated us as like their own. And we wound up in a camp in the Midlands of England, in a rolling moors countryside. Oh, it was so beautiful and peaceful, with cattle and sheep farms and little lanes that we would hike, you know, march through in training. And the little small villages with their pubs. And so we were in England until from February until we went over in June of 44. At first, we had very little training in England because England was so crowded with troops, there was not enough room to really maneuver. So we had a little rifle training and mostly marches through the countryside, and which was enjoyable. And we had passes to the various villages and pubs and dances, and we all had a great time in England. Then we received our orders to pack up and ship south towards Southampton docks. However, at first, this is before the invasion, and we wound up at the docks. At first, before we went to the docks, we went into this large barbed wire enclosed tent camp. We were all people who were slated to go into the invasion, and the invasion was so secretive that no one was allowed in or out. During the time we were locked up, and we heard through rumor that suddenly D-Day, June 6th, had occurred. Well, we were all disappointed that we weren't involved in the initial invasion. However, it turned out that we were glad we didn't because of the high casualty rates. We finally, about a week later, or less than a week later, we went down to the docks in Southampton to board an LST ship. These were large flat-bottom ships that were designed to land troops right on the beach. The front ramp would come down and all the troops and trucks and vehicles and tanks would pour out right on the beach. Well, at first, when we went to the docks in Southampton and loaded, on either side of us were LSTs offloading the dead and the wounded from ambulances on either side of us. That's all we saw, was offloading of those ambulances, and our hearts sunk because then we realized we were getting into something. So on the trip over, channel to Normandy, the seas were pretty rough at that time, so they issued us seasick tablets, a package of seasick tablets. Well, I was so fearful of becoming seasick, I took all of the tablets at once. I soon fell asleep in a corner of the boat. There were no bunks. I just lie down in a corner and I slept, and I happened to sleep we boarded at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and about 1 o'clock the next day, they shoved me and they called me and they said, "Hey, we're here." I got up, and in the distance I saw the beach, and it was very quiet, although as we drew close, we could see there was a lot of wreckage, and it was like a jungle of wreckage. But there were no bodies on the beach. However, again, there were LSTs unloading both ambulances of the dead and the wounded from the Normandy combat, but also long lines of German prisoners. Before we were landed, we were issued gas protective clothing and gas masks because they expected the Germans to use gas. And we had to waterproof our artillery pieces of machine guns, because we actually went in off the water, although personally I didn't get wet because we were riding in a vehicle, a high truck vehicle, pulling our cannon, but the water sprayed all over the equipment. So we had to go quickly to a de-waterproofing area, and it got dark. And under complete blackout, we waterproofed our equipment, our cannons, and by pouring gasoline over them, all over. And if anybody ever lit a match, the whole place would have gone up. Then we're all ready to go to the front. And our sergeant of our gun section, we were 15 men in a gun section with two guns. We boarded our vehicles and we're off. It's the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night, middle of morning, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, completely black, dark, no headlights, just cat's eyes on the truck so we could see one to the other. And we're going down this gravelly road at first, and we're riding and riding, and suddenly we hear somebody yell, "Halt, halt." And apparently it was this American infantryman. He was dug into a foxhole on the side of the road, and he told us that if we went a little further, the Germans were right up ahead. Apparently we got lost. So we quickly decided to get out of there and correct our position. So it took a half, we created a heck of a racket to turn our equipment around in this narrow gravelly road. We had to unhook our guns and manually turn them around, turn the trucks around. And then just as we were pulling out, apparently the Germans heard the racket that we produced, and they started to lob in 88 artillery. Now, this is the first time we were ever experienced incoming artillery and shrapnel, and we still didn't know what it was, but it was little pieces were flying all around, and I was hanging onto the tail end of the truck, and there was a tarpaulin, and a piece of shrapnel whizzed right by my head. And the truck driver in front, a piece of shrapnel just missed him and thudded into the wood of in back of his head. Well, we got out of there fast, and we finally found our position in the front. We were a battalion of 900, divided into different gun sections. And while we're in the front, we were broken up to go with various portions of the infantry battalions and the artillery battalions. We had to protect them. So our assignment was to work with the 315th Infantry Battalion and the 904th Field Artillery Battalion. We were like one. We arrived at the front, and suddenly it was dawn, it was lighted, and our position, we wound up in the middle of this beautiful apple orchard. It was June, it was a sunny day, flowers and buds on the trees, and it was very quiet that morning. And we thought, hey, if this is war, it's not that bad. Then suddenly everything opened up. Artillery and German machine guns and our offensive. And initially we moved around a lot in Normandy. And we set up in this field, and we're in this field outside of La Haye de Puy for about a week. And we weren't allowed to fire our anti-aircraft guns at night because that would give our positions away. But every night, as soon as it got dark, which was double British summertime, got dark around 11 to 12 o'clock in the evening, fully dark, we'd hear an airplane go over us, and we knew it was German from the sound of its engine. And that used to be called, the name of that plane, we called it Bedcheck Charlie. It was a German observation plane. And if they saw a flicker of light, they would direct their artillery to that location. So nobody dared open fire at it. And we finally moved out of that position. And after a couple of weeks, one day, the sky filled with thousands of American and British bombers. And when I say filled, one would look up into the sky and see complete density of airplanes flying over. And then, shortly after that, and as they flew over, they released this tinsel that was to deflect the German radar. Very shortly, the earth opened up. It was like an earthquake, a thunderous roar just in front of us. And there was a lot of undershooting where American troops were actually bombed right on the lines. This happened a lot. As a matter of fact, one of the American generals was killed by that bombing, General McNair. We first swung up towards Cherbourg, and our division, along with some other divisions, we liberated Cherbourg after a few days of battle. Then we swung down towards St. Lo, and we didn't go into St. Lo. We went to an adjacent town called La Haye-de-Puy, where we set up our position in a field. Now, this was really, the battles really started to thicken. And this was the hedgerow country. Hedgerows consisted of fields about a half an acre in size. And the hedgerows were there built up of hedges that accumulated through the centuries, and they were perhaps about 8 foot thick and about 10 feet high, practically impregnable for anything to go through. So we could be in one field, hedgerow field, and the Germans could be in the very next field, and we wouldn't know that they were, either of us would know that either of us was there. Well, we first went into this hedgerow field, and as we drove up to the field, the entrance to the field, we saw this German soldier sitting with his back against a tree, and his eyes were open, and he had his rifle across his knees, and we all trained our guns on him, and we could have killed him, but, you know, we drew closer and closer, and we saw that he had a bullet hole through his forehead, and he was dead. And he looked alive. Well, some of the guys went up and wanted to see who it was. You know, they were curious. They took out his soldier book and his other mementos. And then the human side of the war came to us when we saw pictures of the soldier and his family and his children. When we moved into this first position, hedgerow position, there was another lane opening on the other side of the field. So we went, out of curiosity, to reconnoiter up that lane. That lane, there must have been about 15 or 20 American soldiers who were lying dead in that lane. And there was blood on everything all over the place. Apparently they had recently just been killed before we moved into that field. And, you know, and then the war gradually came to us and we realized the seriousness of it. But again, we were young and we wanted an opportunity to fire at the enemy. And we did. We had plenty of opportunity. Since we were our primary function was anti-aircraft, we also used our light artillery pieces against the German ground troops. As the infantry would advance, we would fire over their heads, and we would put out quite a heavy fire. You could just imagine 40 millimeter firing 120 rounds a minute and quad 50 caliber machine guns with tracers firing. So the result would be, as we'd fire into bushes and trees, the trees would fall down. It was like we were mowing everything down. And the wars were different. Very rarely did we see Germans attacking right to our guns. Wars were conducted differently. Most of the casualties were from artillery on both sides. Their artillery, our artillery. Their artillery was very effective. They had this German 88 gun, which was almost rapid fire. And it was designed, again, for firing at aircraft. But then they determined that it was, the Germans determined that it was very effective against tanks and incoming attacks. The Germans that we found out afterwards during the war was actually a very superior fighting machine. They had already had experiences in the war against Russia for a couple of years, and their previous combats conquering France and the lowlands. So they were very experienced soldiers. And of course, they were defending positions which we had to advance into. So it was kind of difficult because they already had prepared positions that we had to occupy. We were trained on our equipment. We knew how to handle our equipment very well, and we were trained in digging foxholes because of the desert training center. That's all we dug. And so we did a lot of digging in to protect ourselves. But emotionally, we weren't trained. None of us knew or expected what war was like. We were like brothers. There was actually no rank, no difference in rank. Everybody knew everybody else's job, and we were always there to protect one another, to help, to everybody was borrowing cigarettes and food and rations from home, and we were literally a band of brothers, and we can still consider that. After the bombing, the heavy bombing, was the breakout into France. We switched from the First Army to the Third Army under General Patton, and we swung down towards southern France to Le Mans and Laval, and we swung over near Brittany to this Mont Saint-Michel in the distance. And that was a beautiful sight. We wanted to go to see it. At that time, there was no causeway out to it. How people went out to it was when the tide went out, they would go in. They were allowed to travel in by vehicle. And when the tide came out, it was an island. And but instead of going into Brittany, we swung around in an arc, and We entrapped the Germans in a large encirclement. I forget the name of what they called it, but after a few days, we encircled around in a loop in the south, us and other American divisions, and the British encircled around in the north. And in the middle of that loop, a bulge, practically an entire German army was pulverized. And when we went through, what we saw was really carnage. German soldiers lying all over the place. And at that time, the Germans were not entirely mechanized. They used a lot of horse and wagons to pull their artillery and other equipment. And there were dead horses lying all over the place. Through France, and we had a lot of combat in France, and crossing the Seine River, going up to Belgium, practically the farthest advance, fastest advance of any division on the front. And then we swung down through the Ardennes area where the bulge was going to occur in December, and we swung down into Alsace. And we went past Strasbourg, and on our right flank was the French First Army. But then we went into winter, and winter was very demoralizing. Our armies were trapped in north in the Battle of the Bulge. We were about 50 miles from the Bulge, but it was considered the same battle. We were advanced into Germany, in Alsace. And in order to not be encircled by the Germans, we had to retreat 50 miles. And in one night, it was an orderly, somewhat orderly retreat. We didn't just leave our guns or anything like that. We went, but it was during a snowstorm. And it was we usually carried the infantry on our vehicles as we advanced since to avoid them walking long distances. Because the division was mostly pretty much mechanized. Well, that night, we couldn't accommodate all of the infantry, and on either side of us were long rows of infantry. This is the middle of the night, walking in a blizzard. Each infantryman had his hand on the other guy's shoulder in front of him, and they were walking, and they were actually sleepwalking. And it was a slow trudge, like if you saw movies of Napoleon's retreat from Moscow, that's what it was like. And it wasn't a good thing for Americans to see. We finally pulled back. We then were relieved, and we went up north to Holland to train to cross the Rhine River. While we went through the winter, and this was March already, and we were pretty tired then of war, but we had to cross the Rhine River to go into Germany. And we were on one bank of the Rhine River, and we used to take turns on our guns. And I was sleeping in a very deep foxhole that the Germans had previously dug. And one morning the ground trembled and shook just like an earthquake. And I heard yelling and screaming, and with rocks flying into my hole, and then everything stopped. And when I got out, apparently we were bombed, and with a direct hit on our 40 millimeter gun, twisting it like a pretzel, killing one man. He was thrown about maybe 25 yards. And the other three guys on the gun were buried underneath the gun. It was, see, the gun was set up on the banks of the Rhine River, and it happened to be sandy soil, and that's what saved a lot of the guys. It wasn't the enemy bombers that bombed us. It was American bombers, and by mistake, they were supposed to bomb the other side of the river, and instead the lead plane, the B-25s, swung on our side, released the bombs, and killed and injured quite a few of the people in the artillery and the infantry. The very next, well, the very, that same day, well, I was hit and my ears, you know, were bleeding, and I was, had concussion and so forth. But then, and I went into an aid station to be treated. Then the very next morning, or during that day, that same day, we received replacements, a new gun, and early that morning at 5 o'clock, we drew up to the banks of the Rhine River to cross. And we had these small boats where the ramps would come down, and we all boarded these boats with our artillery pieces. And we crossed the Rhine River under shell fire. And we got on the other side of the Rhine River very quickly, and we went into the Industrial Ruhr. And that, the Industrial Ruhr was actually the heart of the manufacturing area of Germany, which had been completely pulverized by American and British bombing. And it took us days to get through that area. And then finally, this was in March, and April passed, we were around that area mopping up German positions, and we had other small skirmish battles. Then finally the war ended for us, the VE Day. We continued on into to meet the Russians in Czechoslovakia. We were outside of Pilsen in Czechoslovakia, and the Russians were in Prague, and that's where we met them. Of course, VE Day, we were all relieved. However, we had to go on guiding German prisoners and experiencing contacting survivors of the death camps, which is very, very poignant for a few of us who were Jewish, because we heard the stories of what happened, and we never realized, nobody ever told us, and it wasn't publicized, how terrible the camps were and the Holocaust and the exterminations. I spoke to a lot of people who were there. Some parts of our division went in through the camps. The war was over, and fortunately, it was VJ Day. And we were so happy because we were actually slated to go to board trains to go across Russia and Siberia to fight the Japanese in Manchuria. Well, since the war was over, they shipped us all back to France, and they placed us in these large 10-city camps to wait transportation and go back home. All the camps were called, there were many of these camps, and each camp was named after a popular brand of American cigarettes. I happened to be in Camp Lucky Strike. Now, the reason for the names, there was Camp Chesterfield, Camp Old Gold. That's because there was no war, and the guys had a lot of freedom. There were a lot of passes. People were going into Paris, Brussels, etc. And all you had to do was go out and pass for 3 days into the cities, but you had to return in 3 days to check your orders, the bulletin board for orders to ship out. But we were there, happened to be there until the early part of November. And we had a great time in Europe. I went to Paris and I visited the Louvre Museum and all the, I was very interested in architecture at that time and art. And I saw all of these famous places. I went to Brussels and I met a lot of very nice people. We finally received our orders and we boarded a train. We went down into Marseille, France. We boarded a Victory ship. This is a largest ship operated by the United States Army that was larger than a Liberty ship, and with great accommodations, great food. Now, we left in the middle of November, and it took us about 10 days to cross the Atlantic. As we pulled into New York City, the port to land, we came in and the tugboats were blowing their horns and they were shooting streams of water up in the air, and on the dock bands were playing and people were cheering. However, before we got into the harbor itself, we passed Statue of Liberty. And as we passed by, it was late in the afternoon, the sea was calm, and it seemed like we floated very slowly by. We all lined the rail, and just about everybody had tears in their eyes. That was when the emotions got to us, and we realized we were home. We got, I know myself, when I got on the dock, and the people were cheering on the dock, I couldn't even look at them because tears were streaming down my eyes. In retrospect, I felt that I had been part of history, and I never regretted being part of that history. And I was always proud, even to this day, that I'm proud that I had served. We boarded another train, and we went to Camp Kilmer again. We stayed overnight. The following day, we all dispersed, went our separate ways, and the Army put us on trains to Boston. We went to Boston, and then another train to Fort Devens. That same day, they took us into a large room and discharged us. We all, after that, we all boarded taxis. We all piled in at taxis. We, a group of us fellas from Boston, piled in together and my friends into a taxi. And we went to near North Station where we had our parting drinks, which lasted for about a couple of hours. And it was lucky. I was sober enough to get on another cab to go home. Well, the cabbie asked me where I lived and I told him. So I said, well, how much do I owe you? He says, no charge. And finally I got home, and apparently I had called my parents that I was coming home. So they were prepared, and all the neighbors in the street I never thought I would make it, but I was home.